Please join me in a warm Detroit Economic Club welcome for Mark Mariel.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Rod Gillum. I appreciate that very warm introduction, and I want to thank Rod Gillum for many, many years of friendship and support and for being a great Detroiter and also a great urban leader. Let's give Rod another round of applause. Thank you, Rod, and certainly to Steve and the team here at the Detroit Economic Club. Thank you for inviting me back. I was last here on October 9th. 2008, and the beginning of the Great Recession, and less than 30 days before the election of Barack Obama as president. We'll talk about that later. Let me also acknowledge and thank other Urban Leaguers who are here. N. Charles Anderson, the president of the Detroit Urban League, a longtime Urban Leaguer, a longtime public servant in this community. N. Charles, thank you for your work, your service, and for you and your team for being out today with me. Thank you very much. We've also got two National Urban League board members here. David Clooney, where's David? David Clooney from JP Morgan Chase. Thank you, David. And new National Urban League board member, Patrick Lindsay. Thank you so much. Patrick just joined our board. I was gonna tell some stories, but Steve's got me on a tight clock, so I don't want to burn up my time in trying to get you to laugh a little bit, but I do want to say thank you for arranging for a rare Detroit warm front to come through this city today. I really appreciate it. I'm out of here this afternoon before, and I'm going to take that warm weather with me, but as a fella from Louisiana, you know, this cold weather, It agrees with me a little, but not a lot. So thank you very much. And let me just, Detroit, I want all of you Detroiters to know that when I think of Detroit, I think of one of America's most important 20th century cities. Truly, it was the city that pioneered the idea that people could have a pathway to middle-class jobs. And on that foundation, the foundation of the automobile and the manufacturing industry, Detroit became the city in 1957 with the highest median income for its residents of any city in the United States. Detroit, in many respects, represented what other communities wanted to be. Also, it was one of the first major American cities to elect an African-American mayor when in 1973 the late Coleman Young became the mayor of this city. A man whose career I followed in my home because he was a friend and colleague of my father, as well as followed in the pages of Jet Magazine, which was my historical biography back in those days. But it's also a city, but let me say this, it's also a city which has brought great joy because the Tigers, the Pistons, and the Red Wings, have brought championships to this city. And I can tell you the Lions are on the way. And I tell you that as a Saints fan, it took us 44 years and we'd have had another Super Bowl if we hadn't been ripped off. Just for the record. But they are on their way. They are going to make it to the Super Bowl. But also, Detroit is a city that forces us, even today, to re-examine both national and local policies, particularly to re-examine trade policies. That as we reflect on Detroit and Detroit's rise and Detroit's challenges, those trade policies had an impact on this city's robust and substantial automobile manufacturing industry and the jobs that indeed went along with it. And I know Detroit is now a city working and grappling with the challenges of its 21st century vision, What will the city be in its in the 21st century? Who will participate and benefit in the 21st century as the city seeks to reposition itself and remake itself? It is an important challenge, and I hope some of what I say today may give some insight and guidance to that. But I want to talk to you today about why in this country these are both the best of times and the worst of times. Of course, for those that embrace the idea that these are the best of times, we just celebrated the 100th month of continuous job growth in the United States, the longest continuous streak in modern American history. Now, I must say for the record that of those 100 months, 86 of them occurred under POTUS 44, that's Barack Obama, and 24 of those months occurred under POTUS 45, that's Donald Trump. And I was asked recently on CNBC if I would give Donald Trump any credit. I said I would give him a spoonful of gumbo, not yet a bowl. Because in fact, and this goes back, when I stood here on October 9th, 2008, this country was reeling. We were in the beginning of losing millions of jobs each month. And the cards that Barack Obama was dealt were as difficult set of cards as any incoming president since Franklin Delano Roosevelt took over in 1932. Whereas when Barack Obama handed off the baton, I say he handed off an economy improving it with tremendous momentum, and it is positive that that momentum has continued, and I hope it continues. But it's a momentum with many imperfections and challenges. These are also the best of times because technology is transforming our work and our lives. There are both positive consequences and challenges associated with that, but it is making so many things much easier to do. When it was cold, cold, cold in New York a few weeks ago, and my wife looked at me and said, "We need to go grocery shopping," I said, "I heard about this thing called Amazon. Maybe we can lay right here under the covers. I'll pull out my iPad, and you know what? You just tell me what you want, and it'll be here this evening." Technology is affecting our lives in many, many, many ways. These are the best of times because, truthfully, notwithstanding the challenges we face with high school students, and we've got some great high school students. Give a wave, high school students who are here with us today. They give a wave, we give a hand to all of them. High school graduation rates are higher than they've been in modern American history. Not where it ought to be, but improving. And that improvement needs to be faster, more comprehensive, and more complete. So in many respects, we can look at this country and we can say these are the best of times. But inside us and gnawing us and affecting our psyche and our thinking, we understand that these are also the worst of times. For example, for the third year in a row, hate crimes continue to rise in this country. The largest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history, which killed 11 people at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. Black shoppers gunned down, minding their own business at a grocery store in Kentucky. Swastikas drawn on the office of a Jewish Ivy League professor at Columbia University. People of Latino descent being harassed for speaking Spanish in public. Hijab-wearing women targeted in road rage incidents. Neo-Nazis bragging online about a murder. These are also, in many respects, the worst of times because notwithstanding the fact that the unemployment rate is as, as low as it's been, and we've had 100 months of continuous job growth. The other side of that coin is that we have the lowest home ownership rate that we've had as a country in some 40 years. We also have the widest gulf between the haves, the have-mores, and the have-nots in this country than we've had in modern American history. We still have the persistent and continuous gap between black employment and white employment, where black unemployment, although it is down, is still twice as high as white unemployment. All of these create the fault lines of the challenges that we face today. I want to talk to you today about a distinction, and much is made about the divisions in our country. But I don't want to talk to you about partisan divisions, and I don't want to talk solely about racial divisions or generational divisions. I want to talk to you about something that is more challenging and more dangerous for this country. And that is the fault line between what I call the concept of nationalism and the concept of patriotism. They are two distinct and different things. The late Charles de Gaulle said that patriotism is when love of your own people comes first. Nationalism is when hate for people other than you comes first. And de Gaulle confronted the nationalism of the Nazis, who sought to create a greater Germanic Reich, emphasizing German ethnic identity across national lines to the exclusion of every other ethnicity, which led to the extermination of Jewish people and any other people who were literally deemed by Hitler to be subhuman. That was the philosophy of German nationalism. Today, there are other autocratic regimes in the world which are teetering towards the rhetoric and the policies and the undergirding philosophy of nationalism. Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines, the Kim dynasty of North Korea, the leader of Serbia, and certainly Vladimir Putin of the Russian Federation. This idea of nationalism is manifested in our own politic by the efforts to create from a nationalist instinct a mainstream, normal, legitimate political party. It's the obsession with pandering to, quote, a base in politics. It's the idea that nationalism, no matter how it is wrapped, is the cheap suit that white supremacy and exclusion are trying to wear in the 21st century. That nationalism seeks to take America and create first-class and second-class citizens based solely on ethnicity or religion or national origin. We must reject the idea of nationalism, but we must understand what nationalism is and why it is distinct from the idea of patriotism. What is patriotism? Patriotism, I submit to you, goes much farther than shouting USA, waving a flag, or proclaiming ourselves as patriots. Patriots embrace the values that made the United States of America the country it is. Patriots understand that the history of the United States is an imperfect history, and that there were many flaws along the way, and that generations of people have sought to work to improve American democracy and the American system. I submit to you that what we want to be in the 21st century is 21st century patriots. Those who place love of our people and our nation above the idea that we need to distrust, not tolerate, and hate others. It's a value proposition that is bigger, I submit, than political party or political ideology. It's a value proposition which is embedded into the words of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. It's a value proposition which is based on equal opportunity, the concept of justice, the concept of tolerance, the concepts that have always been the moral high ground in American life. So I submit to you, and let me share with you how I see American patriotism, or what I call 21st century patriotism. And I believe it is has three fundamental pillars to it. The first is the protection of democracy. Now, democracy, ladies and gentlemen, has been under attack. It's been under attack in many, many, many ways. Since the Supreme Court struck down important provisions of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, some 40-plus states in America have sought to erect barriers to the ballot box. They've created voter ID laws. They want to cut back on early voting. In one state, they did away with registration on election day. In some cases, they've reduced the number of machines in each precinct or polling places. In other places, they've consolidated polling places to make the distance between one's home and one's polling place 5 times as far. Regrettably, and to my dismay, the Supreme Court has been an enabler of this, if you will, pernicious attack on American democracy. 25 states have enacted new provisions. But it goes even further than that. There's an active effort, an active campaign, which came to fore in the 2016 election, where foreign actors sought to impose themselves upon the American electoral system. All one need do is read a Senate report or an intelligence report to understand that the purpose and the animating idea behind the Russian interference in the American election system was to accentuate racial divisions in America, to create false fights. On one hand, set up a fake Black Lives Matter Instagram page. On the other hand, set up a fake neo-Nazi Instagram page, recruit people, and then start having them attack each other online until all their followers were worked up into a frenzy, when in fact, it was as though the Wizard of Oz named Vladimir Putin behind the curtain was manipulating both sides of this fight. That's what's been going on in the American election system. So not only is democracy being challenged with restrictions on voting, it's also being challenged by the actions of foreign actors. America need not be surprised. These tactics of election interference were a staple piece of strategy utilized by the Russians in the Eastern Bloc during the Cold War. This is nothing new. It's just new in that now these tactics are being utilized here in the United States. We must stand up for democracy. I say to people, Russia may interfere today and it may help somebody you like. Russia may interfere tomorrow and it may help somebody you don't like. I say to Russia and I say to Vladimir Putin, hands off American democracy now and forever. And the same holds true for any other nation on any other continent that wants to interfere in the American democratic process through which we elect our leaders. We must expand access to the ballot box if we are going to continue to be the citadel of democracy. Here we are fighting, I believe the number is having spent $7 trillion in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and Syria seeking to create quote-unquote democratic regimes, trillions of dollars, lives of our soldiers, to impose democracy. We cannot stand 1 minute for anyone to attack democracy from within or narrow the ballot box. We must stand up for democracy. An American 21st century patriot stands up for the D, democracy. An American 21st century patriot stands up for the idea of diversity in all elements, in all aspects, in all institutions, in all agencies of American life. Stands up to say that all Americans deserve an equal seat at the table in corporations and in government and in technology and in higher ed, in everywhere we are, and that we have to work towards that. The reality is the changing demographics of the country that we hear about are going to change this country. I have a great deal of excitement about it, but I'll tell you why I have a great deal of excitement about it. If you are a student of world history and you look back all the way to all of the great nations, the great communities, the great empires in humankind, whether it's the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, the Ethiopians, the Incas, the Ottomans, you can go all the way back to everyone you can name. Every single one of these nations was predicated on either a single race, a single religion, or the power of the bayonet and force to hold it together. None of them were held together by a set of values. So we have, and America is on the brink of becoming, for the first time in human history, yes, ladies and gentlemen, human history, being able to emerge as a multi-ethnic, multi-religious democracy, a democracy which is stitched together by values, not religion, not race, not nationalism, but held together by values that we all embrace. That's what the idea of 21st century patriotism is all about. And that is what diversity is really all about. It will require a commitment. It will require work. But it requires, above and beyond all, for those of you who are leaders, an eye on the future and an embrace of the future and an enthusiasm of the future and not a fear of tomorrow. The third D is dignity. Dignity, ladies and gentlemen. In our public discourse, it means creating and defending a climate where we can disagree on public policy in a civilized way. Reject cheap insults, mimicking, mocking of people, mimicking disabled people. Dignity in public discourse isn't merely a nicety, ladies and gentlemen. It is a necessity. If we are going to be true role models for our young people, how we speak and talk when we disagree, and we can have sharp disagreements, is essential to 21st century democracy and essential to the patriotism that I ask you to embrace in the 21st century. These three D's, I believe, are a framework by which all of us as Americans can guide and lead and help this country transition itself into the future. What does it say about our past? What does it say about our future? When I look at the past, I look at the 20th century. And when I look at the 20th century and I look at America of 1900 and compare it to America of 2000, those two Americas are very different places. And they're different places because the leaders of the 20th century, through trials, tribulations, and challenges, brought about some significant changes. Number one, they brought about a technological leap forward unprecedented in human history. Do you remember America before dishwashers? Do you remember America before washing machines, before air conditioning systems, before indoor plumbing? Do you remember an America before televisions and radios and automobiles and airplanes? That was America of 1900. The technological revolution that we see today, I would tell you, pales in comparison to the technological leaps of the 20th century. And those leaps change the arc of history. Those leaps change lifespans in America. That generation also leapt forward when it came to social and economic justice. It was a century where women earned the right to vote after a pitched 25-year battle, which culminated in the passage of an amendment to the Constitution ratified in 1920. It was a time when the commitment made after the Civil War to African Americans of full citizenship and the right to vote were reaffirmed by the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act after a long battle in the streets and in the courts of America. It was an America that faced down two efforts at repressive world domination in 4 years. On one hand, in the European theater, there was Adolf Hitler. In the other hand, in the Pacific theater, there was Emperor Hirohito. The American involvement in those two wars, both of those folks got their butts kicked in 4 years. Kicked, done, over, surrender. That's the 20th century. That's the 20th century. And so today, we face our own challenges. And I think that our challenges are not greater than the challenges of the 20th century. But I think our challenges are going to test. They're going to test our will. They're going to test our commitment. They're going to test our basic embrace of the values that make this country great. And I believe that we have the power. We have the power to, if you will, help this nation take this walk, take this leap, take this jump, and transition itself. And I think that's what the true American patriot is. The true American patriot is going to love the country because it loves its values. The true American patriot is going to love others because they embrace those values, regardless of race, creed, color, religion, orientation, political ideology, or disposition. The true American patriot is going to understand that America has always had greatness and always had darkness, and that the challenge is, can the next generation overcome the darkness of the past while upholding the greatness? And I believe that that is our challenge. At the National Urban League and at the Urban League movement, we are involved on the ground in 90 communities across the nation, working with people trying to help them achieve economic independence. But we're also a voice. We're a voice that talks and works about building bridges, and building bridges based on principle, building bridges based on values, building bridges on a combined and unified embrace of what the nation has to be if it's going to live up to its true values. So today, I ask all of you to make a commitment. And to make a commitment. Make a commitment to say no to this clumsy, silly, ham-handed concept called nationalism that's trying to creep into the American body politic. Say it is wrong, say it is no. And those that speak it and those that embrace it, they need to go do some reading. They need to read of the horrors of Hitler. They need to read of all the repressive regimes. That's not the America we want. We want an America that is bound together by the great values that have always guided this country. And we want to be up to the challenge of our generation to make the country stronger, make the country better, so that when the time comes, when we hand the baton off to the next generation of young people, they will say that you did your job, you fulfilled the challenges, and you met the difficulties of your time. That's before us. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Mark H. Morial. I'm the president of the National Urban League, and I authorize this message.
Thank you. Thanks so much for sharing with us. Stay at the podium thank for some questions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Mark.
Yeah. Thanks, Rod. Is it working?
It is now. Okay, great. Mark, thank you so much. I think that your reputation for being candid was with us here today, so we appreciate that. Let me test that a little further with some questions from our audience. Mm-hmm. So this is a local question, but you've seen what's going on across the nation. Detroit is going through a transformation, but gentrification remains an issue, not only here, but in a number of urban communities. What do you think can be done to make certain that the entire community is involved in that transformation?
Thanks for the question. Gentrification is perhaps the most preeminent local issue of our times. Whether it's Washington, D.C., or New Orleans, or Atlanta, or Detroit, or Chicago, conversations about gentrification are taking place. It is not a new challenge that cities have faced. So here's the idea. The idea is you have to balance growth with the principle of equity. And to me, what does that mean? I said this in New Orleans 2 weeks ago. It means that everyone wants to redevelop their downtowns. But those downtowns have to be redeveloped as neighborhoods where not just the highest income people can afford to live. And what does that mean? That means that cities and municipal governments have to impose requirements on real estate developers and say to them, we'll let you build here, but we want a number, 20, 25, 35% of the apartments, if you're building apartments, to be affordable, to be reachable by a certain level of income of people in the community. Number two, I think that every city should be called on to have a comprehensive development plan for its neighborhoods, not just its downtown. And that has to be engineered by the city's leadership. Enlightened business leaders understand that to build a city where there's a prosperous, healthy downtown and neighborhoods that lag behind is a formula for the risk of the downtown. Number one. Number two, community leaders also have to recognize that building a healthy downtown can benefit the neighborhoods if the jobs that are being created are available to, and there has to be a strategy for people in the neighborhoods. We did some downtown development in New Orleans. We did a casino. I remember when the Detroit team came to see our team. We put requirements on the developer. They had to agree to percentages of local hires. They had to agree to percentages of minority hires. And we put those requirements on them because they were building a casino on our land with tremendous support from voters that had voted to authorize the project. So it really is a question of whether there's gonna be a, now this is creates a tug of war, and the key is to get balance, not have an either or proposition. And I think that's this is gonna be an issue all across America. Let me tell you why it's an important issue. What we do not wanna do, how many of you all have visited Europe? And Europe has a reverse that we had. It had all the poor people living on the outskirts of major cities. So they pushed the poverty beyond the eyesight, thinking that somehow it meant that the risk of the poverty wouldn't affect the visitor industries and the others. Then it comes back to bite you. Then it comes back and there are consequences associated with that. So in the 21st century, we have to build communities that everyone can live together in. And it's gonna require local interventions and local public policy. This is where City Hall has the strongest hand. And sometimes with the support of state agencies, have very, very strong hands. You're not saying to developers, don't come. You're not saying to people, don't build. You're saying we're going to require you to build in ways that benefit all of us. And I can tell you, most responsible developers who are not just motivated solely by how much money they can make, but are motivated by a sustainable project, are willing to play by those sets of rules.
So in our earlier session with the students, one of the words of encouragement from you was about the importance of getting a college education. But there's always debt associated with that. Do you have any thoughts on how to decrease that burden on these young people as they take on this increased debt?
If I had a magic plan, I would announce for president last week, like everybody else. It's a tough issue. But it has to be confronted and it has to be dealt with because it is untenable. I just did a little math in my head. I went to the University of Pennsylvania. My parents borrowed money for me to go. And then when I got to law school, I borrowed money on my own to pay at Georgetown. And I remember how much debt I finished with. And I remember how much debt I finished with vis-a-vis my first year's salary. So my first year's salary as a lawyer at a law firm was more than the total debt that I had graduated with. Now you have young people graduating with 3 to 4 times as much debt as their annual salary. Something's wrong with the ratio. And we have got to find a way to make. I like the idea of moving towards perhaps free college, free community college. It would have cost us, let me tell you what it cost us, $80 billion a year. Now, what does that number mean? $80 billion. You know the tax cut that just got passed? You know how much that costs? $150 billion a year. You could have cut the tax cut in half, given a tax cut, made it smaller, and with half the money, put a program in place to provide free college education at public colleges and universities, or you could have increased the Pell Grant so that people could afford to go to certain private colleges and universities for free. There's a way to do this. If there's a will, there's a way. It costs money, but money is all about priorities. What's more important to us? We could have gotten both for the cost of the tax cut. You didn't have to throw the tax cut out. If you wanted to put $1.5 trillion in costs on a 10-year program divided by 10, $150 billion a year, you could have gotten a tax cut half the size and free college education. That's the kind of, you know, leadership we have to deal with the real issues. We've spent $7 trillion on the wars overseas. $7 trillion on the wars overseas. I'm not here to say we shouldn't have spent any of it because I always supported the war in Afghanistan, not the war in Iraq. But the question is, suppose a portion of that money, $1 trillion of it, 1/7 of it, would have been redirected. Then you would have paid for 10 to 12 years of free college for the students of this choice. What's going to make this happen? These 18-year-olders, these 17 and 18-year-olders, if when they become voters, they vote with a vengeance. They turn out in large numbers. They demand what they want. As long as politicians can look at young people and just say, you know what, they're probably not going to vote, then they're not going to pay attention to these issues. But you see, college education is not just an issue for young people. It's an issue for parents. It's an issue for grandparents. How many friends of mine are working a second job, going into debt to ensure that their children have the opportunity to either go to college or to go to graduate school to have that opportunity? We got to deal with this.
Gun violence is an issue that it's big around the country, but it disproportionately impacts a lot of the major urban communities. What should the government do to rein that in?
So fundamentally, basically, I'm a believer of a system of universal background checks. right, with not a single loophole, so that when one buys a gun, they have to undergo a detailed, thorough background check. Look at their criminal record, look if they're on a terrorist list, look at if they've had mental health issues in the past, a thorough, complete background check. That is what we have to, what most Americans don't realize is that a small portion of people own probably 50% of the guns in the country. Gun collectors, people that own many guns, versus the sort of the idea that most people out here own one gun for either recreational purposes or personal safety purposes. I think if we can get that through, one thing about a universal background check, I don't know if it polls at 70% to 65% or 70%. This is an issue that special interests are blocking. And I say to people, put that in place as a basic fundamental issue. I'd reject the idea that somehow we say, well, we have a discussion about how many lives would it save. If anything saves one life, it's worth it. If you have a, if you place value on human life, you'll want to try to stem. Here's the other thing and why we need greater mental health interventions. I'm not sure, but there are more deaths with weapons self-inflicted than there are deaths with weapons where someone else uses a weapon. So that problem, suicides, are up in the United States, which is why background checks and a much greater emphasis on mental health and mental health interventions are just essential. If we're going to be serious about this issue, it's going to require, now I'd like to go beyond background checks, but I'll take background checks as a starting point, because I feel like that's something that for which there's broad consensus in the American public, not amongst politicians, but amongst the American people for something like that.
So Mark, just to get to know you a little better on a personal level, how about our lightning round? Mm-hmm. Something on your bucket list?
I want to take 25 of my best friends or 50 of my best friends. I want to rent the most spectacular yacht and go off for 2 weeks in the Mediterranean. I want to go hang out.
All right, my
forget friend. Forget the world exists, but it's got to be 20, maybe 50. I need about 50 of my best friends, right? Any takers?
A person other than your family members that you would like to have lunch with.
So two people I'd love to have lunch with. I don't think I can have lunch with anytime soon. That would be Muhammad Ali and Nelson Mandela. I think I got to wait till I go through the pearly gates for that. But then I said, you know what? I think I'd like to have lunch with Alicia Keys.
Be careful, I know Michelle. Okay. One of your favorite songs, Mark.
Oh my goodness. I'm a James Brown fan, y'all. I like the song The Big Payback. But then I also like Solid as a Rock by Ashford and Simpson, which I just think is a beautiful song.
Favorite team growing up?
The New Orleans Saints.
Your best sport?
Best sport. I was probably a better basketball player than a football player. I played both, but probably.
The last book you read?
I'm reading a book now on one of our trustees, Bob Brown. It's a biography of a man named Bob Brown who is a rags-to-riches story, an incredible person. Many of you probably have not heard of him. He's a member of the National Urban League Board of Trustees. He was an African-American who worked for Richard Nixon, was one of the people who helped found the MBDA, Minority Business Development Agency, served on corporate boards. He's just an inspirational person, and I'm reading his biography right now.
One of your favorite movies?
I love The Godfather, y'all.
A favorite vacation spot?
The Galapagos Islands. Anybody heard of the Galapagos Islands?
Yeah.
Sensational, right? Off the coast of Ecuador, yeah.
Describe Detroit in one word.
Cold. No, you know what? Grounded. Detroiters are down to earth. Detroiters are grounded. You know, Detroiters have a little bit of the South in them, right? I guess everyone here has their roots in the South. I don't feel, Detroit doesn't feel like the Northeast to me. It feels more like the South in some ways. So I'll say y'all Detroiters are grounded, but it is cold here, y'all.
Now you might want to take a moment for this one. Advice to your 25-year-old self.
Don't be afraid to fall in love.
We'll end it on that note. Thank you so much.
Mark Morial, you are solid as a rock, and it won't be another 11 years till we have you back. Thank you. Another round of applause, please, for Mark Morial. Rod Gillum, outstanding job as presiding officer. Thank you for all you do. Ladies and gentlemen, hope to see you February 12th. This meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.